Hello. I don't think I wrote that, did I?
Well, hi everybody and welcome. How are all you writers doing? I hope that you had some thoughts about a couple of the questions I asked at the beginning of our first seminar, especially about what is the story, what is your story you're telling yourself about your book? Because the reason I ask is the thing that usually keeps you from having what you want is the story that you have about why you can't have it. I don't have the time. I'm not sure it would be worth it. I'm not sure I'd know what to do. You only need to do four things to make a change. I didn't talk about this last time, but this is just simply a different way of saying it. Only four things to make a change. First, you have to get disturbed. Something undisturbed won't move. The beginning of the change, any change, is to be disturbed, perturbated, and then to look honestly at what disturbs rather than to disregard or rationalize or explain it away. So first, get disturbed. Two, make a plan. Three, know your purpose. Why do you want it? And four, have a result that you commit to. This is a must. The focus specifically on the result. Something you must do. Not want to do, ought to do, should do, but something you must do. If your book is that, if your writing is that, it will result in a book. Now, some of you, I know from earlier correspondence, may not be as interested in a book. If that's the case, honestly, rather than as a compromise, and you truly are interested in writing blogs and writing something other than a book, that's great, as long as it's not a compromise. So, and I hope the other thing that I mentioned at the beginning of last time, take a moment and write the title of the book you intend to write or in the process of writing. That makes it real, the title and the subtitle. So we're going to talk more about the craft of writing today, specifically about that. But first, any thoughts or questions or comments that you have or any responses from the perturbations of last seminar? Anything you'd like to talk about?
Well, Dave, this is Igor Sobestar.
Welcome. Dave, here. Go ahead.
I have questions regarding the difference between the silver bullet and the back cover.
Get a little bit closer to your microphone and get off the speakerphone if you can. It's hard to hear you. Can you get off the speakerphone?
Yes. Is this better?
Way better. Go ahead now. Would you start over?
Right. I am interested in differentiating between the items 3 and 4 in your 8 items here about writing a book before you actually start. And that is silver bullet and back cover. What is the difference between the two?
Well, the back cover really explains what it's about. It's the conversation to the reader that, think about when you go into a bookstore and pick up a book, or even on Amazon, They'll show you the cover, and then they'll show you the back cover. So the back cover really needs to be the communication of what the book is about or what somebody has found it to be beneficial. And it really is part of the sales of the book, but it's the conceptualization of the book. So you're communicating in a clear, brief, succinct way what it's about. Now, that may be three or four people who do testimonials who convey that, but the back of the book is something you want to have in mind. The front, the title, and the subtitle. The title tells and sells. The subtitle tells what the benefit will be for the reader. We're going to go over that. And the back of the book is part of that engagement. Now, the silver bullet is to be able to say in a clear, brief, simple way what the book is about, what it does. Think of that like your hub statement, your hottest undeniable benefit. The challenge is to put it in 10 or 12 words about who it's for and what the benefit is. It's the hub statement of the book. Remember the hub statement, the who, and the benefit. Same with the book. Make sense?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
It's a lot easier to talk about it and summarize it in terms of than to do it. I mean, remember if you did training at CTA, the hub statement seemed like a piece of cake, 10 or 12 words. The hardest thing is to be brief. I mean, for some people, especially me, brevity is not ever anything I ever aspired to. And it's really hard to get it to be brief, simple, and succinct, but you need that to keep the burden of clarity yourself. A number of you who have done training with me have heard me talk about some of the neuroscience of conversational intelligence, that we boot up a particular mindset in the first few words that we use in the conversation. If it's collaborative, collegial, we boot up a mindset mediated by oxytocin, and it's going to unfold in a different way. The listener is going to process that in a totally different way than if it's critical or judgmental or simply factual. That will boot up a whole different system, and that will process the conversation in a different way. So this is how you began your conversation about your book and how you convey it to the reader. So Igor, thank you, and I hope that's helpful. Other thoughts and comments or questions?
Dave, this is Kip.
Kip, hey, welcome. What are you doing?
Well, I did your book cover exercise, and I help professional retirees create successful transition strategies is my niche. And I did a title just spontaneously while you were talking about it, Retiring with Time on Your Hands, How to Reach Freedom Your Way. And I drew a pair of hands holding an hourglass with sand dripping through it. I felt a boost with that. I mean,
that
I don't know if
like
I'll
a
use
winner. That's a grabber. That does sound good.
Yeah, it was just fun to, and I was going through all the stuff you said earlier about I don't have time and I can't do it and all that. But when I just did it, it really, there was some energy coming out of it. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you. That's great. That's really excellent. And I think you're launched. That sounds super. And to know how to enter that creative state of mind and to sustain it, I think will be huge in writing.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kip. Anyone else? Well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode then. If we have time at the end, I'm interested in questions and conversation. If we have time at the end, I have some examples of voice, and I'm going to talk about that as part of the craft of writing. So if we have time, we'll do that, but mostly I want to address questions in any conversation that you have. Okay, as I mentioned, we're going to talk about the craft of writing. You learn to do something by doing it. Writing is no different. You learn to write by producing a certain number of words on a regular basis. You learn to become an author by rewriting. You're the author of your life story and your written story. What do you do uniquely well, better than anyone else? Who's your audience? In setting your writing goals, be very clear about three things. What your readers need from you, and of course, who they are specifically. What you want to offer them, and what things you understand that you want to convey to the reader. So here are, and this is in your outline, here are some ways to think about your motivation for publishing. There are 12 and counting. People want to write for a lot of different reasons. Here are some. To disseminate your knowledge, experience, and message to readers. As a gift to clients. As a premium with some other offer. For example, an ebook as a bonus for subscribing to your newsletter. To publish with a traditional house using an agent to establish national and international presence as an author. To make money by selling your book yourself. To use your book to make money for other services and products, kind of like a business card on steroids. To establish yourself as an expert. To enhance your client base, as a springboard for seminars, workshops, presentations, retreats, to develop mastermind groups or discussion groups based on your book, to make a difference in people's lives. In our own small way, we each want to change the world. This is how Tom Stoppard, a British playwright, put it. Words are sacred. They deserve respect. If you get the right ones in the right order, you can nudge the world a little. And finally, to leave a legacy. Here's how the dedication of one such book, A Memoir on Parenting, sounds. To Ryan and Lauren, I hope there will be a time when you find at least some of this book interesting, though if I've done a good job of parenting, not revealing anything new. I can't know whether or if it will be tomorrow or a dozen years of tomorrows from now. Know that whenever it is, I will be loving you. May you walk through all your days with love remembered and love renewed. Dad. That's from Making Memories, my memoir on parenting. I'll use it later as an example of one publishing option, because there are 9 or 10 different publishing options we'll talk about, and I'll give you examples for each so that you can make decisions. Now, let's talk about voice. Definite voice is conversational voice. You've had the experience, you write something, and you really go over it, and it sounds good, but then you say it, and it doesn't quite sound like you talking. The writer gives us a sense that we're listening to an empathic storyteller, a skilled raconteur, rather than simply looking at words on paper or having the author read what the author has written as if it's conversation. Now, this is different from following the simple advice, write the way you talk. Voice involves more than accurate transcription. A true essence of conversation comes from attentive listening and dedicated revision. Transcribing talk is not writing, but it's one technique to help cultivate voice. Some writers speak into recording devices to let their voices flow and hear themselves at the same time. One step in your editing process is to read your words out loud. Then you can recast a word or a sentence that doesn't quite sound right, doesn't quite sound like you. Barbara McClintock, an awarded Nobel Prize winner for her study of gene transposition in corn plants, said she made her discoveries by listening to what the corn told her. She described respecting the life and presence of the corn and, quote, letting it come. She said she learned the stories of the plants. She heard them. She watched their daily green journeys of growth and came to know the plants in the way a healer or mystic would have known them from the inside, by hearing the inner voices of corn speaking to her as another being. Now, as a kind of a sidebar here, even in previously contributing to the psychoanalytic literature on empathy as a scientific way of listening, it never occurred to me that an ear of corn had much to say. I suspect that if I'd mused out loud to a colleague that some vegetables were talking to me, he'd call the guys in the white coats. For Barbara, though, it was a true exchange. From the perspective of voice, consider this short passage. I think you'll hear it immediately. I use this passage, which also fits with my philosophy of coaching, as a preface in the last book I wrote as a psychoanalyst, Integrating Body Self and Psychological Self. It's from Anatoly Bouillard's Intoxicated by My Illness. This is the way he put it, and this sounds exactly like him. My ideal doctor, I can imagine entering my condition, looking around it from the inside like an ideal landlord with a tenant, trying to see how he could make the premises more livable. He would look around, holding me by the hand, and he would figure out what it's like to be me. Then he would try to find certain advantages in the situation. He can turn disadvantages into advantages. He would see the genius of my illness. He would mingle his demon with mine. We would wrestle with my fate together, like Rupert and Birkin in the library and D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love. I would also like a doctor who enjoyed me. I want to be a good story for him, to give him some of my art in exchange for his. And we'll come back to voice, as I mentioned, in our discussion if we have time. I want to talk about designing every part of your book. And I want to go through these items, these components for you to consider. This is in the outline because it's important. And the detail is in the outline. The title. 5 words or less that tells and sells. Subtitle, the promise, the benefits described, what the reader will get by reading your book. Silver bullet, a clear, sharply focused description of your book that can be recited in the time that you can do a single sentence. As I mentioned, like the hub statement, it should clearly explain what your book is about and the benefits it will provide to the reader. A mission statement, a 7 to 9 word statement of the purpose of your book. The back cover, ideally written before you write your book, a compelling ad copy of benefits to the reader. The introduction. The problem you address for your audience, why you wrote the book, its purpose, its benefits, and how you'll present it. The table of contents. The book outline. And the query letter. The lead, the body, the bio, and the close. Even if you don't plan to use an agent, it'll help you conceptualize an overview and intended impact of your book. So, let's talk about the nonfiction book proposal. First, why is this important? Even if you don't plan to submit it to a traditional publishing house. The reason is the book proposal is the business plan of your book. It's what a blueprint is to an architect. You need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. As you know from coaching, setting a goal will enhance motivation. Establishing strategies will facilitate focus. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. You should have the end in mind from the beginning. Lewis Carroll said it really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. Which road do I take? She asked. Where do you want to go? Asked the Cheshire Cat. I don't know, Alice answered. Then said the cat, it doesn't matter. Develop an organizing idea with a substantial center. What's your book about? Why does it exist? You'll communicate both of these notions again and again in various ways throughout your book. The title, the subtitle, the headline sentences, the chapter subtitles, all fit a brand, the essence of your book. The nonfiction book proposal is a tool to help you organize and elaborate your concept of a book. Another purpose of the proposal may be to tell a publisher about your book, why it's important, why you're the one to write it, why it will be successful. A good book starts with a good idea. The book's merit should address these primary issues. And I'll say there are five. Why would somebody want to read your book? These are questions you ask yourself and you answer and convey in the narrative. Why would somebody want to read your book? Who is your target audience? Be very specific, just like your hub statement. What is your unique hook? Can the hook and the message support an entire book? What will I be telling my readers that they don't already know? So let's look now at the components of the nonfiction book proposal. First, title and subtitle. The title should contain no more than five words. The reason? A longer title requires the reader to think instead of feel. The title should create a motivating visualization. That's why I let Kip get away with a couple of extra words, because he made it. We know that more people think in pictures and learn in a visual way, about 70 to 80%, than learn in an auditory or kinesthetic way put together. So the title should trigger positive images, not negative ones. Its focus, and you heard what Kip visualized, that hourglass and the hands. Its focus should also be positive rather than negative, not even the avoidance of a negative. Neuroscience tells us we get what we focus on, not what we want. So if you focus on the avoidance of a negative, you still focus on the negative. The title should pass the airplane test. Now, this is my personally devised test that came to me spontaneously many years ago when a publisher called me and asked me to write a blurb for the dust jacket of a book that he was publishing. I asked, great, I'll be happy to, what's the book's title? And he told me, and I said, I knew him by first name. I said, Morton, I'll be happy to review the book if it had a different title, but this one doesn't pass the airplane test. And he said, okay, Dave, what's the airplane test? I said, if I'm on an airplane and someone sees the book I'm reading, I don't want to be embarrassed by its title or feel stupid to be reading it or have somebody else wonder if I have whatever problem the title promises the book will fix. He thanked me, had the author change the title, and sent me a nice bound galley to review, and it did amazingly well. I also have a subtest for titles that may pass the economy class but aren't quite ready for first class section. That's a different matter, though. Now, there are exceptions to everything. Here's one exception to the rule of five words or less for a title. It's a bestseller by child and adolescent psychologist Dr. Anthony Wolfe. And this is the title, not the subtitle. Get out of my life, but first could you drop me and Cheryl off at the mall? Two, the overview. A compelling overview of your book, 1 to 2 pages in length, should communicate what your book is about and show the essential worth and marketability of a book rather than a magazine article or newspaper story. The overview should be a clear, concise statement, including four elements: what the book is about, why it should be written, how you'll write it, and why you're the best person to write it. Now, as you're beginning to see, by the time you do the book outline, you have a 40 or 50 page document, you've already done at least a third of the work or more of writing the book and organizing in this way. Three, markets. This section should, and the way you're shaping your thinking in doing this, the market section should contain information about who will buy your book, who you're writing the book for, why it should exist, and your strategy to sell it. Four, the competition. The competition section spells out the results of your research and assessment as to the viability of your proposal, the competition, any complementary books, and what's unique about yours, how you're going to support the idea of your book's existence. It will give you a clear idea of what else is out there, and that's exactly what you need to know. Five, promotion. What you'll do to help promote and sell your book, including these maybe specific areas, regional and national presentations, publicists, faculty or consultant positions with network promotions, memberships with marketing impact, email, collaborative or promotional or affiliative partners, interviews for the book release, articles that you're going to write, blogs, your platform, the number of people who follow you will be what determines the success of your book. Whatever kind of publishing you do, whatever kind of publishing avenue you decide, you do it yourself, you do it through a traditional publisher, that's the first thing. That's the first thing an agent's going to ask you. You decide to go, what's your platform? How many people follow you and would be interested in buying your book? Because that's the first question a publisher's going to ask the agent. What's the platform? Six, author's background. Emphasize your background and experience as it relates to the book. Seven, chapter outline. This section, its organization and persuasion, is crucial. It is huge. It should contain a table of contents and a chapter-by-chapter outline with chapter abstracts. These should be at least half, if not a full page, for each chapter. It's a synopsis of each chapter. It could be as little as two or three paragraphs, up to a page each. These chapter abstracts allow you to show what you can do without having to write the book. It's your blueprint for the book. And as you're seeing, if you use a traditional publisher, you only need to send your book outline and a sample chapter. And the publisher will make a decision on that basis. Then you write the book. Eight, sample chapter. The sample chapter, usually chapter one, simply proves that you can do the job. Engage the reader from the first sentence. Look at some recent nonfiction bestsellers. Blink, Outliers, Freakonomics, Predictably Irrational, Social Intelligence, or The Secret Language of Money. Chapter one in each book begins with a story. A powerful story engages the reader and captures the essence of the book's message. So think about a story that launches your book. The nonfiction book proposal usually runs anywhere from 20 to 40 pages plus the sample chapter. Now, the book proposal is not just a sales tool for the writer. It's an essential teaching tool for the writer. It's your game plan, your superstructure, your blueprint. This book proposal serves as a map for you because it requires you to understand the meaning of your book and to articulate what your book is about. It requires you to think about why you're the person to write it. Why would anybody be interested in it? These are the demands you should already be placing on yourself when you first consider writing a book. In fact, the first month or two of creating your book may be about investigating your idea and writing your book proposal. It may take longer than that. The seven habits of successful writers. One, create a specific plan, including your schedule for writing. Remember, this whole seminar is about the craft of writing. A specific plan, including your schedule for writing. stick with it no matter what. Sometimes one of the most important things in life, as well as in writing, is to show up. This schedule is simply a writing plan that doesn't have to be detailed or onerous. It may look like some version of any one of these possibilities. I'll write for 2 hours, 5 days a week between 8 and 10 p.m. on these days. I'll draft 500 words of writing each day, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. I will create 2 chunks a week. I will create an outline of the book by a certain date. I will create an annotated outline by a certain date. Focusing on a simple, specific action plan sets up the best potential for your effectiveness and mastery. Divide up your work. Focus on and complete one thing at a time. There's always something you can focus on. During my specialty training in psychiatry, one of my first-year supervisors had a really puzzling picture on the wall, a photograph in which everything seemed curiously out of focus. I met with him every week. I glanced at the photograph to finally, toward the end of the year, I mustered the courage to ask him about it. I said, "Steve, tell me about that photograph. What's going on?" He said, "Look carefully, Dave. What do you see?" Well, I walked over to the photograph to get a closer look. Closer didn't help. It still seemed out of focus. I saw no particular aesthetic value in it. My experience and considerable interest in photography didn't help. And I finally said, "Steve, the only thing I notice is that there's only one branch of one tree in focus in the entire picture." He nodded. He said, "That's why I have it hanging there. It's my reminder that while things may seem confusing and blurry, there's always at least one thing you can have in focus and see clearly." This is why he was a great supervisor for first-year residents. 2, the 7 habits of successful writers. Habit number 2, when you write, write. Don't combine writing and editing. Writing and editing are 2 different parts of the brain, 2 different mindsets. You cannot do both effectively at the same time. Plan separate times for each task because different parts of the brain are involved. 3, take one step at a time. Have a small, specific, definable goal. You know this from coaching. Write in small bursts. The first draft may be done at various times, bit by bit, and may be a compilation of several stacks of pages from various times. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed to average 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. He was interviewed immediately after the race and asked, how did he manage to keep going when he was exhausted and knew he had still thousands of miles ahead? He simply responded, "I just kept running to the next telephone pole." One step at a time. 4, find your most efficient way of writing and stick to it. This depends on your work and performance and your learning style. It may be the computer, where you see visually on the screen your words as you produce them, writing longhand on a yellow page where you grab it and physically put in, or dictating for later transcription. Do what fits your learning and creativity style. Also, pay attention to your biorhythms, your best time of the day for the creative process of writing, and the time of the day for more objective work like editing. These are not going to be the same, by the way. Pay attention to your biorhythms. Now, in Texas, we say it this way. It's easier to ride a horse in the direction it's going. 5, read your work out loud. This can be a really effective element in editing, a way of listening on another level. If possible, and I've done this a number of times, join a writer's group to hear your work and other work read by others. What usual writer's groups do, what I've done when I've conducted a writer's group, is to have someone else in the group read a segment of your work, and you can't interrupt. You have to listen to it. Because think about it. When a reader's reading what you've written, you don't get to, that's where I meant to do this, you need to pause there, even though I didn't put it. You don't get to do all that. You listen, and you get what you get. So it's good discipline. 6, do adequate research. Effective writers know that good research is about pursuing questions and information of themselves, as well as resorting to books, websites, reports, and interviews. One way to review new information is to have Google Alerts delivered to your email. And you probably all know about this, but it's one of the ways I keep up with the world literature on a number of subjects. I have probably over 24 Google Alerts that I get. So go to Google Alerts, Google Alerts, and put the word or the phrase that you want to follow, that you want to be notified about anything that's written about that subject. And if it's 2 words or more, put it in quotes so you won't get segments about each of the words. So, for example, quote, behavioral economics, end of quote. I get an email once a day of anything in the world literature. That ranges from anything in newspapers to journals to other blogs, other things that relate to this subject, an abstract, each entry is the title of the article or the book, a little abstract, and then a link to the article or to the blog. So you get to, see what interests you. If you go to the article, you can, what I do is copy it and print it so that I stack up these things and more efficient when I go through a number of articles. And 7, read the writing of others. We learn by reading. Read what instructs as well as what stimulates. Read from other related fields. Stretch yourself. You will find your best balance for reading and writing. Now, here are the top 6 mistakes successful writers avoid. Think of all the hassles I'm saving you guys right here. 1, avoid passive sentence construction. As you reread and edit your work, convert passive verbs into action language whenever possible. It reads better. 2, strive to be the 4 components from William Zinsser in The Art of Writing, the 4 components of good writing, same 4 components of good speaking. Clarity, brevity, simplicity, humanity. Significant work goes into keeping it simple and making it look easy. Keep the burden of clarity of communication. Don't shift it to the reader or listener. 3, show, don't tell your audience. Use stories and metaphors, combining a good story, right brain, with pointing out the story's lesson, left brain, engages both sides of the brain, balanced learning. People accept more ideas and ideas more readily when their minds are in story mode as opposed to a more analytical mindset. Show, don't tell. Melville didn't write a story about whaling. He wrote a unique action and dialogue drama between one guy and one fish. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. James Watson, the scientist who with Crick discovered DNA, said, I can remember something when I fit it into a story. A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. Our brains are wired for stories. Lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. Muriel Rukeyser said, the world is made up of stories, not atoms. 4, keep the I to a minimum in order to acknowledge and engage your reader. 5, lose the jargon and fancy phrases. Hemingway believed that 1 to 2 syllable words worked way better than longer ones. Don't try to impress your audience with your intellect, vocabulary, or research. Your reader wants a savvy friend who explains things in a down-to-earth way, who also happens to be an expert. 6, be a good storyteller. When you carefully craft a speech or tell a story, the art lies in evoking the desired emotional response within the listener or the reader, rather than expressing yourself or telling what the receiver's action or reaction should be. You enable the reader to have the emotional experience. We learn from the poets who offer their art to the reader or listener as a doorway to the listener's own experience. One of the storytellers I studied with told of an experience he had going through an airport in Chicago. A woman stopped him to say how much she enjoyed his presentation and how it had stayed with her for 4 years. He asked her to remind him of what he had talked about. She said, "Oh, I don't remember at all what you talked about, but I always remember that story you told." So here are some exercises. Now, again, the outline and the workbook component that you downloaded and hopefully printed out will have components for each of the seminars, but here are some chunking exercises. These are 4 chunking exercises that I want to highlight here. And chunk is a piece of writing, maybe about the size of a newspaper column, that looks at a single subject. So that's a chunk. So exercise 1. Write a single chunk. Treat a single subject in a complete self-contained way. This may be an anecdote, a vignette, an exercise, a description of an event, a complete thought, or a case study. It could be, and should be, the subject related to your book. 2nd exercise, write 4 more chunks. You'll see that chunks are the building blocks of nonfiction books. Exercise 3, fit those chunks into your outline. See what the chunks illuminate or describe to further a section of a specific chapter of your book. Exercise 4, plan a month of writing. After you've written these 5 chunks, fitted them to the outline, you may want to revise your outline. After revision, decide what chunks to write next. For these, you'll be more aware of what you want to write, and you can make a writing schedule. Now, here are some important areas of focus for the serious writer, which, of course, each of you guys are that. 1, the mission statement of your book. As you know, in business, a mission statement is a statement of an organization's primary purpose, the strategies to achieve that purpose, and its fundamental values. A mission statement, a personal mission statement, can clarify and give meaning to your daily activities. It adds focus and commitment to what you do. Consider the mission statement for your book. A mission statement has 4 elements. This is in your outline too. Ideals, purpose, strategies, and goals. Ideals are the core values that motivate and guide you, that define the important elements of what you're going to convey in the book. Purpose, what do you want to accomplish, what you wish to accomplish, the benefits the reader gets that are consistent with the ideals. The strategy, the art and science of a plan of action. This is how you'll conceive, craft, and deliver your book. And goals, you guys know this from coaching. Effective goals are SMART goals. Specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, time-bound. Create a mission statement for yourself as a writer. It can guide you. It can remind you what you're meant to do. This can become a compass to guide your story to completion and fulfillment. Write it down. Look at it each time before you begin writing. I'll share mine with you. My mission statement, to inspire and guide people to achieve their unique, most empowered life and business stories. Important areas of focus for the serious writer, 2, a business plan for your book, the book proposal. We've already talked about that. Number three, a timetable. Perhaps, if it works for you, a calendar of completion of each aspect of your book. A daily and weekly schedule. This is absolute. Five, your writing office. The space of your own, as Virginia Woolf emphasized, a room of one's own. Your tools. Adequate support from computer to business stationery and cards, books, references, magazines related to your writing. Seven, continuing education in writing, as well as in your subject matter and in marketing. Those are the three components that you learned in terms of coaching. Your basic skills, tools, methods, and principles of coaching, business and marketing. Same with writing. And eight, I want to go back to the writers group. The huge leaps I made forward, the huge leaps I had in going forward in writing, came from attending initially a couple of writers groups at the University of Iowa. In them, I learned as much from the other participants as I did the writer who coordinated the groups. At a University of Houston imprint series, we did something I've subsequently incorporated into a boot camp for writers, and as I mentioned, hearing your writing read by someone else. You can't tell the reader where to pause or to use a certain inflection, and you'll find objectively listening to your own work read out loud can be hugely beneficial. At least record it and listen back to the recording. Now, something I want to conclude with. Your belief systems. If you want to change your life, first change your mind. How do you do an inventory of beliefs that may be limiting or compromising? Analogous to impressionistic painting, each of your experiences is a dab of paint on a pointillist canvas. Only when you step back and view the entire picture do you recognize that the points form a pattern of a particular segment of life, and that the segments have their own unity. You create each experience, the patterns and the composite image. Each is at a different level of awareness and conceptualization. You're always free to change your mind, always free to change your beliefs and core assumptions about who and what you are. Changing your mind not only alters your brain, but also transforms your life. But first, you have to be aware. Prediction and expectation based on the past create repetition. But when based on the present and future, prediction and expectation create possibilities. A belief system constructs either an obstacle or an opportunity. Consider this. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. To say it a different way, show me an obstacle, I'll show you a desire. Now, the secret here is that an obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it safe to want if you're afraid. Here's an example. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking relentlessly and ferociously at a cat, as if to say, just let me at him. Now, the next frame showed the cat. Cat wasn't too shabby. It looked really mean. It was at least as big as the dog. In the next frame, all of a sudden, in the middle of a ferocious bark, the leash snapped. So the dog was free to go after the cat. The dog was astonished, scared to death. He quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot. Then he could again strain safely at the leash and bark his ferocious, just let me at him. So here's the principle. When you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, for example, I can't find time to write, reflect instead on the underlying desire. And here's the principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're then ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. Okay, we have a little bit more time. I want to give you a couple of more examples of voice. and then we'll go to our discussion mode. Here's an example from my other favorite psychoanalytic author, Adam Phillips, and this is from his book on kissing, tickling, and being bored. So the first question is, what are the preconditions for the recognition of an obstacle? And the first dissertation is, one can recognize an obstacle, which can mean construct something as an obstacle only when it can be tolerated. Only through knowing what we think of an obstacle can we understand our fantasies of continuity. Now, maybe here's a little bit better example. Another physician, Oliver Sacks, and this is from The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. My work, my life, is all with the sick, but the sick and their sickness drives me to thoughts which perhaps I might not otherwise have had. So much that I am compelled to ask with Nitschke, as for sickness, are we not almost tempted to ask whether we could get along without it, and to see the questions it raises as fundamental in nature? Consistently, my patients drive me to question, and constantly, my questions drive me to patience. Thus, in the stories or studies which follow, there is a continual movement from one to the other. One more example. This is from Annie Dillard in The Writing Life. Think about how, with some of your favorite authors, someone could read a sentence or two from that author, and you know immediately that that's that author. That's voice. That's what I'm talking about. Here's from Annie Dillard. There are some things that human beings can only see out of the corner of the eye. The niftiest examples of this gift, familiar to all children, are small, faint stars. When you look straight at one such star, it vanishes. When you move your eyes to stare into the space nearby, it reappears. If you pick two faint stars side by side and focus on one of the pair, it disappears, and now you can see the other in the corner of your eye, and you can move your eyes back and forth, turning off the star in the center of your retina and switching the other one on. Something like this happens in music. You can't really hear certain sequences of notes in a Bach fugue unless at the same time there are other notes being sounded, dominating the field. The real meaning in music comes from tones only audible in the corner of the mind. And then from another component of Annie Dillard, when you write, lay out a line of words. The line of words is a miner's pick, a woodcarver's gouge, a surgeon's probe. You wield it, and it digs a path you follow. Soon you find yourself deep in new territory. Is it a dead end, or have you located the real subject? You'll know more tomorrow, or maybe this time next year. You make the path boldly and follow it fearlessly. You know and go where the path leads. At the end of the path, you find a box canyon. You hammer out reports, dispatch bulletins. So we're in discussion mode now. I'm interested in your thoughts and questions and comments. What do you think about what we've talked about? Does it give you an idea of how to go about creating a plan for your book? You'll notice in the outline there are two references to books about book outlines. And both of those are excellent. They're different. Each book outline I've done kind of a compilation of the two, but both have given me really good ideas, and both contain examples of some successful book outlines so that you have a good example of that. And I would recommend, if you can, get both of them. Those are good examples of how to conceptualize the book outline and some samples of what they are. And I've kind of distilled both into the outline that you have and that I spoke to and spoke from the same. I'm speaking from the same notes that you have about the outline. I'm just kind of elaborating. So you have exactly what I have in front of me. And that's a compilation of those two books, that outline that you have. But I think it's a good good skeleton. Thoughts, comments? I'm getting a little lonely here. Anybody want to ask or add or comment about any impressions you have?
Dr. Dave, this is Deborah.
Thank you. I appreciate it. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. I re-listened to last week's recording, and then I was reminded that I was supposed to be looking for that yellow Jeep. Unfortunately, I don't know if there's enough in South Texas. I didn't see one. But
okay.
I'm keeping my eye open. The other thing is making a title for the book. Because, as you said, our homework was to draw a sketch of our book with our title cover on it and then to also draw a picture of it on a table or in a bookstore, which I understand the value of that because then we have the visualization of the manifestation of what we want. Here's my challenge. And even though today you even said five words, you know, max for a title, I mean, do you think most writers come up with a title first? Or the topic, and then the title kind of evolves.
I think it happens both ways. You heard Kip's approach. I have a struggle with titles, and sometimes that's the last thing that I come up with. So I think it really depends on your style. And the last the last couple of books I've done. I've had a kind of a debate with my agent about a title. So sometimes it's in collaboration with other people about what really is going to work the best. So
that reminded me of something I just watched not too long ago. Again, Julia and Julia, about the Julia Child story.
Uh huh.
I don't know if anybody's familiar with that one, but that's exactly what happened with her book because her original title was rejected, and then they, I guess whoever ended up publishing it, worked with her title.
Yeah.
Because she wanted something else at first.
One of the two manuscripts my agent has now is one that she really didn't like the beginning, the title. It's a totally different book. It's the one I spend a month in the French Quarter in an old Creole cottage each year writing, and it's something different than I usually write. And the one I've done the last two, three years there is one that's with her now called Engaging the Ineffable. It's reflections, and the subtitle is Reflections on Some Everyday Intangibles of the Heart, of the Head and Heart. And it's like 21 different chapters on things that we usually traffic with, like desire, time, memory, nostalgia, belief, hope, story, serendipity, synchronicity. And, you know, we disagreed on this. So I don't think, don't let the title be a stumbling block is my point here. If it guides you, if it helps you, that's great. If it comes to you, that's super. And whatever works, actually. Yeah, I mean,
that's encouraging because I was feeling stumped and I'm going, this might not be good.
The idea of having all these principles is to have principles to guide you, but not be rules that make you sort of feel like you have to fit onto a Procrustean bed. So use all this just to inform you, to inform your creativity, not to limit it. It's a beacon, not a fence.
Okay. Thank you.
So good question. Thanks. Thanks, Deb. Who else?
Dave, this is Kip.
Yeah, please.
Do you have any examples of chunks that we, any links to what a chunk looks like? I hadn't heard that term before.
Think about every one of the stories you heard me tell in what I just said. I'll just have a word, you know, in my outline I've written in, the telephone pole story. I write Terry Fox. So that's a chunk. Now, I love the story. I know it's going to fit somewhere where I need to illustrate, you know, you only need to focus on one thing at a time. And the same with the chunk about the residency supervisor and the one branch that's a chunk. So sometimes a chunk is a vignette, a story. something you believe might be helpful to illustrate something that, that you're going to write about. It may be when you print a number of articles or blogs you get from the Google Alerts and go through a number of those, you may have three or four chunks. I do everything by dictation. I mean, because I'm a talker. So everything I write, I write with an intended audience. I envision my audience, whether it's a person or a group. And every book, every article, every white paper, everything I've written has begun with dictation. Even complex emails, I dictate and do my transcription service for, you know, because it doesn't, I don't have to think. I can think about it without, you know, getting all bogged down that way. So just think about things that you want to preserve and that you might use sometime. See, what I do when I, you know, I dictate all these things is I will, as I get them back, I see a kind of pattern. And if I have an idea of maybe 14 chapters, I'll have 14 folders, and I'll know what folder to put that chunk in. So that already helps me to develop a particular chapter or a particular concept, which is a chapter. So I'll have these ideas already accumulated in that folder, and pretty soon the folder grows and you know, it takes on kind of a life of its own. You begin to get excited about reading about stuff, and it builds. Does that help you at all, Kip?
Yeah, that helps. Thank you.
You bet. Well, we're out of time. Thank you all very much, and thanks for the communication that you've given me and responses to those initial questions. I look forward to picking up right here next time. We're going to talk about the science of writing and then last seminar, the business of writing. So we'll pick up right here next time. Thank you very, very much. Bye now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.